So I want to, you know, give you a story in favor of the next and minimal supersymmetric model. And basically, the story is the bottom line is here in green. You know, one can use this model to simply and simultaneously eliminate any issue of fine tuning, which the minimal supersymmetric model now has. It can, do this with a Higgs mass of order mz, actually 100 GeV to be more precise, as preferred by precision electroweak data. And it can explain, in fact, the biggest of the left event excesses. So it can do all these things simultaneously. And we think it's, well, what is my personal assessment? Maybe 10% probability it could be right, or something close to it. So first of all, I'm just going to remind you that reality is approaching. We've been able to ignore it for many years. Then I'll remind you, and I learned that at least a few people I was talking to didn't remember about the hierarchy problem and so forth. So are there experimentalists in the audience, by the way? Doesn't look like it. So anyway, so I'll skip quickly through this, and then I'll talk about the minimal supersymmetric model and the next to minimal extension and why we want to do it and what that has to do with low fine tuning. And I almost certainly will not get to the points, the fact that the next to minimal model does new things for dark matter and does electroweak baryogenesis very nicely. So, yes, is this battery gone out on me? There we go. So here's reality, the LHC with its CMS and ATLAS experiments under construction. This thing is not going to work for me. There's the tunnel. There's magnets. I don't know when this is working and when it's not. Maybe I better just use the keys. There's the detector. This is the ATLAS detector. I guess, how many of you have actually seen these in person? I don't know, they're quite something. sort of at the scale of this thing here, for example, right around there, that's be a person. This is the CMS detector. So if the experimentalists are getting real, shouldn't we get real? And I claim that the most real theory we have is still supersymmetry because it does a lot of nice things. First of all, it's a very beautiful mathematical structure. It's naturally incorporated in string theory, so some of you should be happy at any rate. Scalar fields have a natural place in supersymmetry, and so there are candidates for the spin zero fields needed for supersymmetry, for electroweak symmetry breaking, in Higgs bosons. And of course, as we all know, if the Susi breaking scale is of order of TeV, we get a solution to the naturalness hierarchy problem, which I don't need to discuss with this group, but you have the quadratic divergence canceled by the scalar boson loops of opposite sign. And if Susi were exact, then you would have a Higgs boson mass squared that was less than mz squared times some standard factor here having to do with the ratio of vacuum expectation values that defines tangent beta. Now, of course, if Susi is broken, then there'll be some residual corrections over here, as you well know, from loops. And these will be substantial or not so substantial, depending upon exactly how much larger the stop partners are compared to the top quark itself. The model you will know all about. I hardly need to tell you. They're chiral super multiplets, they're gauge super multiplets, and the Higgs super multiplets contain the Higgs and the Higgsinos. So all this structure, I'm sure, is quite familiar to you. If it's not, just slow me down at some point. But I'm just want to sort of put it in front of you. Now, of course, since we don't see sleptons and squarks, we know that Susi is broken, and we break it softly so that we don't destroy the cancellation of the quadratic divergences. And this means that we introduce all these soft masses for the squarks and sleptons, the masses for the Beano, Wino, and Galeno, the mass squareds for the Higgs boson, fields and a mu parameter for the Higgsinos. Actually, B mu is the thing that enters the scalar sector, and mu is the thing that enters Higgsinos. And also, there are soft parameters called A, T, for example, associated with the Yukawa coupling of the quark fields to the Higgs doublet. So in order to properly cure the naturalness and hierarchy problem, all these masses should be of order TeV or so. And the mu parameter, of course, plays a special role, which has been a big question mark for all of supersymmetry, for the minimal supersymmetric model, for many years. The big question is, if you introduce an explicit mass parameter, why shouldn't it be either zero or of order the unification or Planck mass scale? So this has always been a problem for the minimal supersymmetric model, and we'll come back to it. But anyway, let's for now assume that all the sparticles reside at the TeV scale. Then, of course, the MSSM does these two wonderful things, right? You get gauge coupling unification, which you don't get in the standard model. And the unification occurs at a nice mass scale of order a few times 10 to the 16th, which isn't terribly far from the Planck scale, so that you could imagine making a connection there. And, of course, the other elegant property is the fact that you get radiative generation of electroweak symmetry breaking. And you all, I hope, are familiar with that story. You start with positive mass squareds for your Higgs fields up here at the gut scale, and you evolve. And one of these positive mass squareds, the up type guy, is driven to be negative as a result of this evolution to lower mass scales. That's what the equations give you. And so that automatically breaks the electroweak symmetry at some point down here. So then the next big question is, how fine-tuned is that thing that is happening here? I mean, is this hard to get exactly the mass of the Z scale of the MZ as a result of this radiative electroweak symmetry breaking? Or is it kind of a natural thing? Okay, so that's going to be a big issue in this talk. Now, once you do this SUSY breaking, then the Higgs boson mass squared has that term I showed you before, mz squared cosine squared 2 beta, plus radiative corrections, the biggest of which is this stop-top loop residual, which is basically dependent upon the log of the product of the two stop mass eigenstates divided by mt squared. So numerically, it's something like this. And if the stop masses were of order 2mt, then you would get a Higgs boson mass of order 100 GeV, and you would love it, because the precision electroweak data prefers a standard model like, this would also be a standard model like Higgs boson, prefers a standard model like Higgs boson, sort of right around 100 GeV, maybe even a little bit lower at the moment. Of course, there's a chi-square distribution. You can say, okay, well, we're on some tail of this, but this is the preferred value.
Question, one often hears sort of an upper limit quoted for minimal SUSY in the Higgs mass, but this looks like if you're making the log bigger, you can make the Higgs heavier.
That's the idea. That's.
Is there anything that would say how big that log could be?
Well, that becomes an issue of this naturalness. If you increase the stop masses, then you're having this quadratic cancellation going on in a very fine-tuned manner. So the usual statement is that you don't want masses above a TeV if you're going to have a true solution to the naturalness problem.
Yeah.
Algebraically, yes, you can take them to be bigger, okay? And you could get a heavier Higgs boson that way. Okay, so anyway, the problem with all this, of course, is that we haven't seen the Higgs boson that is so nicely predicted to be around 100 GeV. And so we have to ask ourselves such questions: is it supersymmetry wrong? Are the stops heavy and the naturalness cancellation more fine-tuned than we would like? Or maybe the MSSM is just simply a little bit too simple. And it's that latter point of view that I'm going to push in the next minimal.
Jack, in this model, you said that the Higgs started out with some positive mass square, and one of them
right.
Not to have negative mass square. Is it robust? Which one?
Yes, it's always the one coupled to the top. That's the big Yukawa coupling, right? Yeah. And that's so the thing that's robust in that sense.
Yeah. Have several of them on ternegative?
People have written down models. You know, if you have very high tangent beta, then you can get Yukawa unification, and then more things can happen. But
okay.
Yeah.
So many things.
Yes, to say the least. So just to remind you a little bit more detail about the MSSM problems, here's typical experimental constraints. And there's this big green swath in the parameter space of M Higgs, and this is the lighter Higgs and tangent beta that's eliminated by experiment, tangent betas. You can open up this region a little bit more if you take very big mixing, that AT parameter, or if you do, sort of a no mixing scenario or, small AT, then, it's even more constrained, and, sort of anything with tangent beta below 10 except in this little wedge here is eliminated. And basically this is, this line here is about a Higgs mass of 114 GeV, which you'll see several times. So anyway, let's come back to this question of, how natural is it to get the value of MZ given, that radiative electroweak symmetry breaking in the evolution equation. So that's summarized by this formula here that says that MZ squared is given by mu squared and a certain combination of the low scale, MZ scale, down and up doublet mass squareds. But these are, of course, coming from the gut scale evolution equation. So then you figure out what that is, and you get a formula like this that says MZ squared is related to all the gut scale parameters. And what you'll see in particular are numbers like 5.9 times the M3 squared. That's not a small number like MZ. M3, as we know, has to be something like 300 GeV according to latest experimental constraints. So this is much bigger. So you've got to have some cancellation here. And those cancellations are getting kind of fine-tuned. Okay, that's the word that goes with this. And it's not, and the natural thing is that MZ should be of order the minimum of the various things that appear up here, which sort of is, things of order M Gluino and M T tilde. That's sort of the very best you could hope for.
What is
M3 Fourier? Oh, sorry. Okay. You see, I never know what people know and what they don't. There are three gay genome masses, one for the Beano called M1, one for the Weino called M2, and one for the Gluino, and that's basically M3. So it's the soft masses associated with the gay genomes of the three different standard model sectors. So M3 is the one that MZ is particularly sensitive to, and that's because M squared HU is particularly sensitive to that Gluino mass. It enters into the evolution equations. Okay. So, it's sort of unnatural to get enough correlations in here to do this. Well, you can sort of set it up. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but if you have very large AT, then you can get some cancellation, but then some other parameter is getting big, and so what one really needs to do is look at it in a global sense. So what is done is to define a fine-tuning measure, which is the log-log derivative. So this is the log derivative of MZ with respect to the log of any gut scale parameter. Okay, so there's a whole long list that we've just given of all the gut scale parameters here, and you look for the maximum possible thing, and that's your measure of how fine-tuned that RGE generation of electroweak symmetry breaking and of the Z mass is. Okay. So how does the MSSM do? Well, it depends a little bit upon AT, this mixing parameter. So if you scan over sort of what I would regard as a reasonable region, and you take, let's just say tangent beta equal 10, it's just a sample value, gay genome masses of 100, 200, and 300, sort of in the experimental consistency domain, and scan over all other parameters, including AT within this range, then here's the plot of F versus that root mean square stop mass. And what do you see here? Well, all the blue points are points with Higgs mass below 114 GeV. So they're experimentally excluded. I mean, if you didn't have the left data, then you would say, okay, well, we'll sit down here at this nice little minimum and we won't have much fine-tuning and there's no problem. But, you know, instead, the red points here are what you're actually allowed to consider. These are the Higgs masses above 114. And you see that fine-tuning is getting pretty extreme here, you know, 130 or something like that. So, you know, in another language, you know, more strongly fine-tuned than the 1% level. Okay, whereas, you know, you might be happy with 10% or 15%, you know, that's sort of what you would naturally expect. Now, if you go to, you know, sort of extreme AT values, then you can do better in this fine-tuning sense, but on the other hand, you're really jacking up AT. So here, again, the red points are allowed Higgs masses, and you can see that you can get to a fine-tuning of, you know, 35 or some number like that, but the AT values compared to the stop masses are really quite large, so, you know, you need to go up to, you know, 3-4 TeV in AT. Well, you know, I don't know, I can't say for sure, but that seems awkward to me at the very best.
AT is the coefficient of the trilinear term.
Right.
So does that become unstable if AT is too large? I mean, it's not a positive definite term.
Right, but it's supposed to be okay up to actually, you know, 3.5 TeV gets kind of dangerous in this, you know, so, but it's a good question. Well, there's electroweak baryogenesis that MSSM also fails at nowadays because you need to have a light stop, whereas the stops have to be heavy to get a heavy Higgs mass, or you can have one light stop and one super heavy stop, and then you have a huge fine-tuning problem, you know, so, but maybe, you know, electroweak baryogenesis is not the means of getting baryons, so one never knows about this constraint, but still, we're back again, at the very least, to, you know, where did this mu come from, and as I said earlier, you know, it should be either zero or order M Planck. Instead, it has to be, for the successful phenomenology here, has to be of order the Susi breaking scale. If it were zero, you would get a very light Chargino of order MW squared over M Susi in mass. And of course, you know, if it's order M Planck, then everything would go crazy.
I understand your this concept of fine tuning parameter F. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to see F greater than 30. Reason is not a fine-tuning, right? Because
right.
F is the logarithmic derivative of some experimental.
Yeah, MZ in particular.
MZ, when you vary some parameter in your theory.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the F for the cosmological constant would be like 10 to the 120.
That's right, yeah, yeah. So this is a milder version of that.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But okay.
Yeah, so, you know, theoretically, you get uncomfortable when F gets to be okay. That large. There's no doubt about it. So then, you know, if you're uncomfortable with the MSSM, what direction do you head in? Well, what I said so far is for a CP-conserving Higgs sector, you could move into CP-violating Higgs sectors. These don't solve the mu issue, and certainly nature has shown very little inclination for large CP violation. But, you know, you could...
But then the question is whether 30 is big or not, because in physics we certainly maybe have... things that some measurable quantity is exponential of some parameter in theory or something. So if I vary that parameter, you know, like tunneling rates or something.
Right, but here it's not really an exponential. You know, it really is just you know, as I showed you, mz squared is coefficients times.
Yeah, you see, F is 10 to the 10 to the 20 is huge, but 10 to 30.
Yeah, I agree. If you're willing to accept large AT parameters, then. But remember, really large AT parameters, then you can get it down to that 30 domain, and then you have to say, okay, well, maybe fine-tuning is okay, but then you have to ask yourself, was AT okay? You know, are you happy with that? You know, I'm not too happy with such large numbers. So anyway, this is one direction that you could go in, but wouldn't solve the mu issue. You still have, you know, some unexplained way of getting electroweak scale mu value. You can go in all these other directions, extra dimensions, Randall syndrome, little Higgs, Higgsless models, all fun, but all kind of messy. You know, I think, hopefully you know enough about these to know that they are a bit messy. String theory does have one useful hint that I want to pursue, which is that it often has extra singlet superfields as part of the spectrum. So let's make use of one extra singlet superfield and see what happens. And that's what defines the next to minimal supersymmetric model. Actually, it used to be minimal next to minimal supersymmetric model, because there's lots of next to minimal supersymmetric models you could define, but this has become the standard notation now. So the idea here, of course, as I'm sure many of you know, is that instead of writing down a new term, you write down a trilinear term involving the singlet superfield and the two doublet superfields, and with some dimensionless coupling, that's important. And the new parameter is then automatically generated, provided the VEV of the scalar component of S hat acquires an electroweak type value, which is very natural. And so then the effective mu parameter becomes lambda times this VEV, and lambda is 0.1, 0.2, some number like that. The VEV might be 1 TeV, so you can get easily 100, 200 TeV for mu very nicely. Now, of course, this is not the only superpotential term that you want to write down. There's also still the Yukawa couplings. And even that is not sufficient because, of course, you have a Peche-Quinn type symmetry associated with this superpotential. You know, with these charges, you have an invariance, and this invariance is broken spontaneously when the Higgs scalars gain vacuum expectation values, and a Peche-Quinn axion, which is massless, will be generated. And so, why didn't you see it? Well, you could say lambda is very small, but why again? You could you'll gauge this symmetry and have a Z prime that absorbs your axion. Or you could explicitly break the Peche-Quinn symmetry, and this is the route that the next and minimal supersymmetric model follows. And the point is that since the S-hat has no gauge couplings, but does have a Peche-Quinn charge, you can introduce any S-hat to any power you want, and you'll break explicitly the Peche-Quinn symmetry. But of course, the best thing to do is to choose n equal 3 here, so that you only introduce a dimensionless coupling constant in your superpotential. So that, again, is the next to minimal supersymmetric route, is to have this one-third kappa S hat cubed, where kappa is dimensionless. And of course, there'd be corresponding soft terms, a kappa A kappa S cubed for the scalar sector, and a lambda A lambda for the SHUHD type term. Okay, but that's not the end of the story, and I don't know how much of this to go into. There's a Z3 symmetry basically guarantees that these are the only terms that you could have, and that guarantees that that you will not have any dimensionful couplings introduced into your superpotential. But if this Z3 is completely unbroken, it gives an early universe problem, because there would be a domain wall in the early universe. So you would have different regions of different directions of this of these scalar fields, and we don't see any of the anisotropies associated with this in our microwave background. So somehow Z3 has to be broken in some appropriate way. So you can do this through the usual game of introducing non-renormalizable operators. This, if you do this appropriately, you'll prefer one of the vacuums over the others. And I'm going to skip the rest because time is not going to be on my side in this talk. But you can. There's a long discussion of using a Z2R symmetry and so forth. I'm sure some of you are interested in this, but I want to keep this on the reality plane here, so you can look at it. I'll post this on my website if you want to read the explanation. But the net result is that after you've introduced this Z2R symmetry and appropriate things, you fix the domain wall problem with some very small terms that have no relevance to our phenomenology at the TeV scale. And so the only things that are relevant at the TeV scale are the superpotential terms that you've already seen with dimensionless couplings, and the scale of the vacuum expectation values is then completely determined by Susi breaking. That's the only scale in the problem. Now, all couplings are dimensionless. Everything is set by the scale of supersymmetry breaking. So that's kind of attractive, I hope you would feel, that just one new scale.
What's the size of the region separated by domain walls in this kind of model?
The size? I can't remember. I'd have to look it up. It's in the papers that I reference. But it's, I
mean, because it seems like the domain wall problem, you seem to think of it as very serious.
Well, there is discussion. Look, I mean, there are papers out there that even claim that these networks could be the dark energy, right?
Right.
And so there's, yeah. So it might even end up being a good thing. So I don't guarantee that that's not the right answer. Okay, that's why I'm skipping through this. There's a lot of discussion of this at the moment. Now, of course, the other nice thing about the next and minimal supersymmetric model is that by introducing a singlet, you didn't change the two wonderful features of the minimal supersymmetric model. You know, singlets don't affect gauge coupling unification. And, you know, as long as the mass scales are right, the RGE, electroweak symmetry breaking, is still going to work very nicely. The singlet is just also going to acquire a VEV when symmetries break. So the new particles are, well, of course, we have a fifth neutralino. We have an extra CP even Higgs boson and an extra CP odd Higgs boson associated with the singlet superfield. So what are our parameters? Well, again, we have the lambda for the trilinear S hat HUHD, the kappa for the S cubed term. We have the soft parameters that I've already mentioned, A lambda and A kappa associated with the scalar sector. We have tangent beta, again, which is the ratio of the VEVs. We have the effective value of mu, which is lambda times the VEV of S. You can think of it either way. So anyway, these, along with, of course, stop masses and things like that, can be viewed as determining the three Susi breaking masses squared for the HU, HD, and HS. So, you know, they're minimization equations, and so you can, you know, go back and forth depending upon what your point of view you want to use here. From the model point of view, model building point of view, of course, you know, we think we're inputting the soft masses squared along with A lambda and A kappa, and these will determine the electroweak scale VEVs, and then we can decide, you know, did MZ get set to the right value or not, given some choices at the gut scale for all of these soft parameters. So, anyway, aside from the stop masses and what have you, here's our list of parameters again, lambda kappa, A lambda, A kappa, tangent beta, and mu effective. So, obviously, the NMSSM is less constrained than the MSSM, and what we'll discover is it's not necessarily forced into awkward fine-tuned corners or parameter space, either by the LEP limits or by theoretical reasoning of any kind. So, many of us think this is really the benchmark Susi model that people should be considering and not the MSSM, which is sort of a bit awkward even from the beginning because of the mu parameter. So we've done some of the usual things. We have this master program for computing NMH decay, Higgs properties, and so forth, checking against all kinds of constraints and minima and so forth, and it's available on the web. We've also developed a program associated with this that checks whether the Higgs bosons can be seen at the LHC, which is something that I'll say a few words about. In particular, starting back in 96, Haber and I and Maroy discovered that you couldn't really guarantee LHC Higgs discovery if the Higgs were able to decay to two light pseudoscalars or other Higgs bosons. This was not in the retinue of channels that people had considered up to that time, and people still have not figured out how to master this kind of decay channel. So if that's an important decay channel for the Higgs, then the LHC is going to have to rethink Higgs discovery.
What is the no-lose theorem?
So the no-lose theorem that I'm referring to here is that in the MSSM,
Yes. There
is you can show that no matter what the parameter choices are, you will find at least one Higgs boson of the MSSM.
Oh, it's guaranteed.
Guaranteed. That's the no-lose theorem. And okay. What happens in the NMSSM is that you lose the no-lose theorem. Okay, if these kinds of decays could be present. And, you know, we've spent some time investigating the nature of this so-called hole. And, you know, our original point of view is, okay, well, this hole is, you know, not that big in a sense of the overall parameter space, so maybe it's nothing to worry about. Unfortunately, I'm now going to tell you that fine-tuning puts you precisely in that hole. Okay? So, again, you know, just to remind you, fine-tuning is the log-log derivative of mz with respect to all by nu gut scale parameters, including a cap, a lambda, et cetera, right? So the question is, how well can we do? It takes a moment to load the next guy here. So the first thing you can do is just take the model, not put in any experimental constraints whatsoever, and just see what fine-tuning does as a function of all the parameters. Then you can say, okay, well, maybe I should make the stock reasonably heavy, say above 100 GeV, and maybe I should make the Chargino above 100 GeV, you know, satisfy a few experimental constraints, and okay, but not constrain the Higgs sector. So that's possibility number two. Then possibility number three, well, okay, here's the red points, is where I put no experimental, no constraints of any kind except the proper minimum on the theory. Okay, and you'll notice that, well, you can get F values below a 10, which is, you know, sort of the measure that we like to have for sort of a swath. There's this little, you know, minimum here, even without any constraints in the vicinity of a Higgs mass of 100. Then I put in some experimental constraints. That gives me the green. And you see we're sort of zeroing in on a Higgs mass of 100 now. That's not Higgs constraints yet, just, you know, stop and Chargino and what have you. Then the blue, we put in base, what I'll call basic Higgs constraints. Now, by basic Higgs constraints, I mean that LEP has a whole bunch of published papers where they say, okay, in this channel, Higgs would be found if this and that, okay? So that's the blue thing, and, you know, we're zeroing more and more in on this 100 GeV. And then you go to the experimentalists and you say, well, are these blue points really allowed? And I'll discuss this a little bit, and they'll tell you no. Half of them, most of them are gone, in fact, because if I combine all the different channels, then they're eliminated. And what you're left with are these yellow big crosses here, okay? And that's what, these are the points that I'm going to focus on, and in particular, I'm going to focus on the blue, the yellow big crosses that are, you know, below F of 10 here, which are, have very low fine tuning. But notice that there's just this natural thing of, you know, the theory wants 100 GeV Higgs to have low fine tuning. And it's sort of what you expect ahead of time in some sense. Now you might say, okay, well, you know, what kind of gut scale parameters go with these nice yellow crosses that I'm going to talk more about? And here's an example. What you discover is that the low fine tuning solutions want a no scale theory, you know, that is Higgs mass squared at gut scale of zero. And the same thing is true for the down and the singlet guys, too. So it's sort of a no-scale theory for Higgs mass squared. So that's kind of attractive. And you can look at other correlations, and some of them are quite nice, too. The other thing you'll see later on is that this value of Higgs mass here with the low fine tuning wants a root mean square stop mass of about 350 GeV or so. So that's sort of nice and experimentally accessible. Now, the point is that the H1 of 100 GeV is only allowed, LEP allowed, if H1 decays into A1, A1. So that was all those yellow crosses. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's ruled out by LEP data. And not only that, the A1 has to decay to two taus, can't decay to two Bs. And I'll come back to this. So these are the scenarios that correspond to those nice yellow crosses that survive everything. Now, actually, we're quite happy with a light A1 because you get a light A1 when A cap and A lambda go to zero. The A1 becomes a pseudo-Nambu Goldstone boson associated with a U1R symmetry. And were it not that the U1R symmetry is explicitly broken by these A cap, A lambda terms, you would get a zero mass guy. So there's a natural symmetry limit that gives this, because small ak and small a lambda really does just give you a nice symmetry limit and does give you a very light pseudoscalar. There's no particular dependence of the fine tuning on a cap. It's just that you've got to escape the left bounds. You've got to have that decay. So it's that decay that's required. Okay, so now I'll show you a little bit more about fine tuning. So again, we'll return to this tangent beta equal 10, M1, 2, 3 equal 100, 200, 300 scenario. Can't read my watch in the light here. Anyway, what I'll show you is that you can get very low fine tuning values. And of course, I'll remind you that this 100 GeV that we keep zeroing in on, this Higgs is standard model-like in these scenarios. It will do exactly the right thing for the precision electroweak data. So here's all these points are now experimentally allowed. It's just I've separated them into red points that have a Higgs mass above 114, and blue points that have Higgs mass below 114, or sort of more in the zone that I'm talking about. And these points are all experimentally allowed in the sense of the blue points that I showed you, not the yellow crosses yet. So all single channel left limits have been applied. Most of these points will be wiped out when I look at multi-channel LEP constraints, okay? but anyway, you see you get, you know, Higgs masses, fine-tuning very low, and even not that big, even if I require Higgs mass above 114. It's better than the MSSM, and this is for modest AT values. Okay, I don't have to take any huge AT of 3 or 4 TeV in magnitude. And in terms of Higgs mass, again, fine tuning, again, you see this minimum at 100 GeV. And if you start up at require 114 GeV or higher, just to be sure you're away from all LEP constraints, well, the fine tuning starts at 20. And that's not too terrible. You know, it's still a little bit uncomfortable. But anyway, you know, why shouldn't it be a solution like that? And again, here, you see that if you're going to have those low Higgs masses and the lowest fine tuning, you've got to have a high branching ratio for Higgs into AA, even based upon the single channel LEP constraints. And then if you look at it more carefully, you discover as well that most of these are eliminated, and it's only if the A is light enough that it's forced to decay to two taus that things are allowed. Okay, so let me remind you of this plot that maybe some of you have seen. So LEP has limits, so let's look at those. So this is a limit on the effective rate for Z Higgs, where the Higgs decays into BB bar, and the Higgs is you know, sort of standard model-like. You want to think about that. And what I've done here is plotted all points where MA is less than 2MB. Okay, and what you see here is, as the dashed line, is their expected limits from LEP, and the solid line is their observed LEP limits. You'll notice they're not the same, and in fact, they seem to have a nice excess here in the vicinity of a Higgs mass of 100 GeV. So is that statistics? Well, it's, you know, 2.5 sigma effect, or is something happening? Okay. So I'm going to claim something's happening, because here are my low fine tuning points with MA less than 2MB, and some of them sit right where you want. You know, about half of them typically sit in exactly the right way in order to explain this excess of events.
What do you mean by an observed limit? A limit usually means something is not observed. I'm sorry, what does that
mean? So, well, expected limit is they ran some Monte Carlo, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they saw, and they said, well, okay, well, given, you know, my background calculations and the cuts that I can make, you know, I expected that I would be able to limit the product, you know, assuming there wasn't a Higgs present, that I would be able to limit this certain combination of, you know, branching ratios and couplings to this dashed level. But they ran their experiment, and they had more events than they were predicting from their standard model backgrounds. Okay. Now, if it were standard model Higgs,
not consistent with no Higgs, or
so, well, it's you know, how it's 2.5 sigma. So experimentalists will say, well, that's not an observation, okay, but it's certainly not consistent with their background either, okay. Now, a standard model Higgs would have given you a giant signal here, you know, somewhere up here, you know, because it would be decaying entirely to BB bar. And so, you know, they can certainly rule out a standard model Higgs decaying to BB bar. But suppose, and this is what happens in this model, the Higgs to BB bar branching ratio is only 1/10 of what you thought it was because of this AA channel. That's perfect to explain this excess.
So is this the best channel for discovering the regular Higgs?
Yeah, it's absolutely. Yeah, these are the strongest constraints. Yeah.
Quarks,
right. Absolutely. So another way of displaying this, just as, again, another LEP plot, is there's something called 1 minus the confidence level for the background. And, you know, the dashed line here is what you're supposed to get if your background describes the data. And, you know, instead they get this curve with this huge dip at 100 GeV, which again, as I said, is sort of 2.5 sigma, so not that huge, but, you know, looks big. And if you redrew, this is the standard model curve, and they say, okay, well, there's just no way that this is consistent with the data. But if I take the branching ratio and divide it by 10, then this curve goes straight through there. Okay?
Knowing what you know now, you would not have turned that off.
That's for sure. It gets more complicated. It's not. Let me come to this issue, okay? Now you might say, okay, well, what about, okay, Z Higgs, where Higgs goes to 4 taus? Does LEP have any constraints on that or not? Well, the answer is yes, and here they are, but you'll notice that the constraints stop at 87 GeV. This is because of somebody telling the experimentalist that the analysis was not interesting above a Higgs mass of 87 GeV.
Who was that?
They won't tell me. I suspect John Ellis or somebody like that, right? He's famous for, you know, making these glib statements that experimentalists take seriously. So that's not to say there isn't data. And so, in fact, you know, every time I meet an experimentalist, I tell them, go access your data. Or give us the passwords so we can do it, or something, you know, go look for this damn signal. Zero progress. Well, a little bit of progress recently is that my collaborator Dermasek gave this talk at Princeton, and Witten got very excited about this scenario and went and sat on their main experimental, the LEP experimentalist, a guy named Tully, and he has promised to either do it by this summer or give us the password so we can access the data and do it ourselves. Well, there are other constraints you could think of, you know, like if the A1 were really light so that it didn't even decay to 2 taus, then you have to get into jets. So each A1 decays into jets. That's the dangerous scenario. The constraints are kind of tough. Just a mode-independent, hadrons only, any kind of hadrons, you know, your constraints run out at about 80 GeV, which is not useful for the scenarios. And if you said that the jets overlap, well, you know, you have some constraint here, but it's not strong enough, as I'll tell you in more detail, to eliminate the type of scenario that we're discussing, unfortunately. So the question is, how well do we, in fact, describe this event excess? So our favorite points are sort of these top 3 or 4 here. And this is the sort of an expected level of something which I won't even try to describe to you. And this is the observed level. So as long as the expected level, that is our prediction is the expected level, as long as the expected level is somewhat close to observed and not too much above it, then we are doing a very good job of describing this excess. And you'll see that these points here are, you know, pretty nice descriptions of that excess. Now, the only way we could get these numbers is by sitting on another experimentalist guy named Philip Beckley at Slack now, who had to send our points through their whole LEP analysis machinery. Okay, that's the only way one can be confident of doing it. And we have many more points now that we'd like them to analyze, but Philippe is busy. You know, these guys are all busy doing CMS or CDF or whatever the hell. Just can't get them to do anything. very frustrating. But anyway, we got a handful of points to they were willing to analyze and tell us, okay, yes, we really were consistent with the data and actually describing it very nicely without violating anything that we shouldn't violate. And one of these points is an A to tau tau decay, but two of them are A to jet jet decay that escape all the LEP constraints.
A came from single field S, is that right?
So A1 is in fact mainly singlet. Okay, so it's a decay to a mainly singlet Higgs.
Is there a particular reason it's so much lighter than the other scalars to which it's coupled?
Right, well, this is the small AKA lambda symmetry limit that I mentioned. So if I take AK and A lambda to zero, that gives me a new symmetry for which A1 would be massless. So I break it a little bit and I can get whatever I want. Okay? Let's see, I'm going to skip some of this because at what time? I can't read my watch here. It's getting late, right? I'm sure. I'm sorry? So in fact, here's a plot of where we are in AK and A lambda space. The yellow points are my favorite points. The blue points are the single channel constraints. And what you see is that you don't really want them to be exactly zero. You want them to be slightly off AK, minus 2 or minus 3 GeV or something like that. And you can actually show this very clearly, that if you actually try to go to the exact symmetry point, then the branching ratio for the Higgs to the two pseudoscalars is too small. I mean, you would have thought maybe you could just go to the symmetry point, but you can't quite do that because that branching ratio declines too much, and you've got to have a, sort of 70% at least branching ratio for AA. But, AK and A lambda pick up radiative corrections anyway, so even if you set them to zero at tree level, they'll get, from supersymmetry breaking, they'll get some loop corrections. So having, a few GeV for these guys is not, in my opinion, for AK is not a problem, and a few 50, 100 GeV for A lambda is also not a problem from these radiative corrections. So, we claim this scenario is very natural in the NMSSM.
Does it increase substantially the amount of missing energy in events?
We haven't come to the fifth neutralino yet, of course, and that's sort of almost another story. But of course, that if it's the singlet neutralino, and we're in this sort of kind of scenario, could be that that is the lightest neutralino. It depends upon M1, but there's a natural tendency for the lightest neutralino to be fairly singlet-like. And that comes to the dark matter stuff that I don't have time for in this talk. I mean, I have transparencies, but I know I'm not going to get to them. What I wanted to do is just tell you a few words about the collider implications. Now, since there are no experimentalists here, I'm not going to do a terribly thorough job on this, but what I want to first of all show you is this table back here. And what you'll see in this final column is the maximal statistical significance that you would get for a Higgs signal at the LHC after accumulating 300 inverse femtobarns per detector. That's a lot. That's like 7 years or something like that of LHC operation. In the usual channels, that is the ones for which the MSSM no-lose theorem was established. And you see the news is not terribly good, especially for our favorite points. You don't have a signal according to the experimental definition. So you've got to do something more if this is right.
But you would have ruled out the MSSM.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, those are out the window anyway as far as I'm concerned. This is what... this is what's
good thing we're no experimentalists.
So when the signals that give you that 1 or 2 sigma significance are things like H1 decaying to gamma gamma, or WH1 plus TT bar H1 associated production, where gammas appear, or TTH1A1 where you do have some B decays after all, so they're very much weakened. That's what happens. It's all your usual channels that depend upon photons or Bs. They're all much weaker than you thought. 1/10 or 1/20th of what you thought they were going to be. Fusion H1 to tau plus tau minus, well, that was a good channel for the MSSM, but it doesn't decay just to 2 taus, it decays to 4 taus. So maybe you want to go back and relook at some of these channels for, things like 4 taus, but also, unfortunately, for 4 jets, because, that's also a possibility that it's not decaying to taus. So anyway, as I say, you might want to look at, I'll just focus on these red things. It may well be, Shoemaker and I are looking at this channel where the Higgs decays to 2As to 4 taus. And, we think we can pull a signal out of this. We're working on this at the moment. And there's a whole bunch of transparencies having to do with cuts and distributions. Let me go back. What happened there? So this would be your final thing. This is some kind of reconstructed Higgs boson mass at 100 GeV. This is the signal only. And where's the background? Well, we think maybe it's not too big, but that's what we don't know yet. Okay, so there's hope. But there's a significant number of events, 100 events per bin here. So it's not a small rate at any rate. You could also do TT bar Higgs, where eventually you get TT bar plus 4 taus. Similar things may work there. You could use this chain decay where the second neutralino decays to a singlet-like neutralino plus a Higgs, and the Higgs goes to 4 tau. This works if the Higgs goes to BB bar in the MSSM. Does it work for 4 taus? We don't know, but it's worth studying. There's also this game of diffractive production where PP goes into PP, so you actually look for protons, color singlet objects, and isolated Higgs in the center of rapidity space, and then the Higgs doesn't even have to be examined because you can reconstruct the Higgs mass from having measured the final protons. And you can do that with something like a 1 to 2 GeV resolution. And then you can say, do I see a peak in this mass distribution or not compared to what I was predicting? And so it's sort of like what you can do at a linear collider, which I'll come to. The problem is, after all is said and done, for 100 inverse femtobarns, you only have about 10 events at best. Actually, our estimate is 3. So you're going to have to run for a long time. At the Tevatron, it looks really hard, but people are starting to think about that. At a lepton collider, of course, you do Z Higgs production. Here are the cross sections. You figure out the event rates. And what you do is, of course, you measure the Z very precisely, say in the mu plus mu minus channel. You look at the recoil. You don't have to care what's there. You just look for the excess, right? And here's a typical excess. And this would be the excess no matter whether it was my Higgs or the MSSM Higgs or the standard model Higgs, as long as it has standard model-like couplings. And so there's no question you're going to get a signal, and then you're going to chop this X up into various different final states and learn everything that you want to learn about the Higgs. So the linear collider would do a bang-up job on this. You could talk about how well it can measure the different couplings, and sort of every error that you see here has to get multiplied by a factor of 3, but still pretty good errors, so one would know what was happening, and one could study the Higgs and so forth. So, that's just more details on what I was just saying. So I'll just say a few words. Is there any time remaining? I can't. Somebody tell me. I can't read my watch in this light.
It's 2 o'clock, but you started late.
Okay. Well, I'll just show you some summary graphs. So, what is new in dark matter in this scenario is the thing that I've alluded to, namely. First, we have a light pseudoscalar, and you know that one of the ways of annihilating dark matter enos, whatever they are, is through a pseudoscalar-type resonance, right? Now, if it's a mainly singlet resonance, then the neutralino, twice the neutralino mass, has to be pretty close to the pseudoscalar mass. The pseudoscalar is also pretty singlet in our theories, although, maybe if you want to consider a broader domain where the pseudoscalar is not necessarily ours, pseudoscalar, but just a general pseudoscalar in the NMSSM. But anyway, the neutralino mass has to be fairly closely aligned to get sufficient annihilation, that's the case if I want this neutralino to be light. I mean, the new feature is the neutralino could be very light, but the pseudoscalar could also be very light because that's the natural thing, in fact. And so you could have a very light dark matter particle and a very light pseudoscalar that was doing the annihilation. So this is not possible in the MSSM. Here is the most extreme thing you can do is get an LSP mass of about 7 or 8 GeV for some very high value of tangent beta. And you know, because you just can't, given LEP constraints, get a CP odd Higgs mass that's sufficiently light. You know, LEP says it has to be heavier than 90 GeV or so. So in the NMSSM, well, let's focus on this, you know, my sort of favorite region, where the LSP mass is a few GeV and the pseudoscalar is twice that. Well, this central dash line here is where the pseudoscalar is exactly twice that. The solid lines here, well, they depend upon tangent beta. Let's focus on the red line, which is, say, tangent beta equal 15. On the lines, I get exactly the right dark matter density. Outside the lines, I get too much dark matter density. Inside the red lines, I get too little. There's too much annihilation. So there's always this issue, and it's always an issue for dark matter of you know, fine-tuning. There's always some fine-tuning associated with getting the right dark matter density, entirely coming from this supersymmetric early universe production and thermal equilibration and so forth. But we can do it, and we can do it for light pseudoscalar of the type that we'd like, and for a light neutralino of the type we like. And so that's the new story. And then the question is, what would the LHC first of all tell you? I'll just say this verbally. Well, the LHC would say, okay, yes, there is a neutralino. We see missing energy. Missing energy in the form of missing momentum is just as good as missing energy in the form of missing mass. You don't really see any difference there. The LHC would say, okay, well, the mass of the LSP is below some number in this case. Maybe they could say, okay, it's below 20 GeV or something like that. They would have no idea what the actual value was from the LHC. And they would never have any hope of seeing the pseudoscalar, maybe from Higgs decays, but would they learn enough about it to know its content in order to compute this relic density? You've got to know exactly how much pseudoscalar is in the singlet sector versus how much in some other sector, the MSSM sector. So the LHC could say, okay, well, some of the relevant particles are there, but that's about it. So you have to go, this is a case where you have to go to the linear collider, and there you can, study the neutralino pretty well. The pseudoscalar is a bit of a problem because it's so singlet. So it's not even clear, and this requires analysis, that the linear collider could study the pseudoscalar with sufficient precision to really say whether you were on the red lines or not. Okay, so there's a bunch of scenarios here, but anyway, I'll just give my conclusion. So if low fine-tuning is imposed for an acceptable model, we should expect a Higgs mass of 100 GeV decaying to two pseudoscalars. Hadron colliders will be a challenge. ILC will be a cinch. Gamma-gamma colliders will be good. The very smallest F values are attained when the other Higgs are kind of heavy, so if you built a big enough linear collider, you could maybe make those. They'll be hard to see at the LHC because there's no big tangent beta enhancements necessarily at any rate. The A1 has a mass below 2 MB, and the A1 has a substantial singlet component. The stops and other squirks are light. That root mean square preferred value is about 350 GeV. So the LHC should see all kinds of supersymmetry stuff, right, if this scenario is right. Just won't easily see the Higgs. So maybe some of these channels will work that I mentioned. Maybe they won't. We don't know the answer. So we don't know for sure that the NMSSM, of course, is the only model that would do this. All I need is these extra decays, right? And so if I complicate the sectors, pseudoscalar sector with more stuff, okay, well, there are probably other escapes. But this is certainly a simple way of doing it. One thing I want to mention about the LHC is that there is this old WW into WW scattering game. And you may see all kinds of supersymmetry. You may not see the Higgs, but after a few years, you will measure WW scattering, and you will decide is it non-perturbative? Is it, you know, just what we would expect if the Higgs were light? Or is it enhanced because, you know, something unlike Higgs is happening? Well, if this model is right, it'll be exactly perturbative. So you'll know that something like a light Higgs is present. You just won't see it. And you'll know that you have to build the linear collider in order to see it. Okay, so anyway, there are also some dark matter conclusions that you can read here.
They can measure they'll be able to pick that out for some precision.
That's right, yeah. So it takes a few hundred inverse femtobarns, so maybe 6 years. By the end of 6 years, they'll know that there are no big enhancements. They won't have a precise measurement of WW scattering, but they'll know it's, you know, sort of in the perturbative domain. Okay.
If the take-plane symmetry is gauged, then you don't have these light particles. The formulation is totally different.
That's right. They go into Z, some kind of Zs or something.
Are those viable?
As models, you mean? Well, it's not clear that they would. I haven't thought about it. It's something that we want to think about. You know, would the Higgs have some extra decay that could explain, you know, how you could have a light Higgs and not see it? And sort of my first answer is no. You know, that if you gauge it away, then you don't have.
But you can make Higgs heavier. I mean, that was the other branch, right? You can make it if you have the singlet. You can still make the Higgs heavier.
Well, you can make some Higgs heavier, but maybe not the one you want to make heavier.
The latest one says that the longitudinal vector absorbs this, acts like this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but on the other hand, you know, well, if the Z prime were sufficiently singlet. I mean, this is the case you want to think about. Suppose the Z prime that gauged this guy were really a singlet and not very well connected to the standard model sector.
Yes.
Could it be really light? Right? So then you would have instead Higgs decaying to two light, nearly singlet Z primes. That's an interesting case to think about, right? Yeah, that you would want the light Z prime in this limit.
I guess there are various scenarios for a so-called invisible Higgs where the decay channel is something we don't see.
Well, actually, you see, invisible Higgs is better than what I've given you, unfortunately. The LEP constraints on Z plus a Higgs that decays invisibly are almost at the 114 G.
Which is a partly visible, right?
Yes, well, I mean, it's going into things that are certainly visible. It's just not channels that they analyze properly, that's all. I mean, if it were really invisible, that's a channel they paid a lot of attention to, and they have a nice limit on that's, you know, at around 114, or really 113 GeV.
But you had that one excess of
yes,
the
right.
Bar that suggested it wasn't totally invisible.
That's right. Yeah. So it's partly you know, 1/10 of the normal BB bar rate, mm-hmm. and then some channel that they didn't look at basically. And that there might be something in if they went back to their data, and there might not be. So it's very frustrating, you know, not having the ability to get these guys to go back and look at their data, in at least in the 4 tau channel, where they should be able to get a statement one way or the other as to whether or not the signal is there.
You think getting LEP experimenters to run your Monte Carlo, to run your favorite models, your wiggle
Right. This is a lesson to me about just how hard it's going to be to get what I want out of the LHC data.
if this possible left channel was analyzed, given the amount of data they've got, how big of a signal do you think you might see?
Well, if it's all efficiencies, right? You know, isolating this channel. I mean, the signal is quite strong. Okay, I mean, you know, because 100 GeV, you know, there are lots of 100 GeV Higgs made at LEP, if it's a, you know, in this scenario. You know, thousands. Okay.
Does anyone have a vague idea what the background is for this?
That's the problem. No, the answer is no. Certainly I don't. And you know, Beckley has some program that he runs that I don't know how much he knows about it for sure, except how the statistics work. I know he knows how the statistics works in this program. But, you know, I mean, all the experimental groups have contributed some information on what channels they have, including the 4 tau channel up to 87 GeV. And it's all buried in this massive program. And, you know, actually, when he first started running this, he discovered some errors in the program because of the questions I was asking. So they had to revise some paper. But anyway, you know, nobody knows. That's
okay. Let's thank John.
Is discovery in diffractive